Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
In a sudden flash, it all comes clear. It's a eureka moment, an epiphany. Hi, I'm Marcus Smith, host of the Constant Wonder podcast. The world offers marvel, meaning, and mystery around every single corner. In nature, art, science, culture, history, we talk everything from bees and beetles to obelisks and asteroids. Experience the thrill of transformative encounter. We'll bring more wonder to your day.
Listen to Constant Wonder wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, welcome to another episode of History Hack. I am not with Alex today. I actually have Kate on board with me, which is really exciting. Kate, hit us off. Who have we got on today?
So we're joined today by Joshua Green, who is a History and Sociology PhD graduate from the University of Southampton. He's now working with a new publisher in the video gaming industry, as well as working towards his first book.
Thank you very much. It's very nice to be here.
So Kate, I mean, this has kind of inspired you a little bit, this podcast. That's why you're on board with me today. Am I right?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I think we need to talk more about mental health. You know, even now, as far as we've come, it's still a really big issue.
No, I totally agree. I don't know what you think about this, Joshua, but coming from a male perspective, as you can correct me here, but, you know, women tend to talk more openly about mental health and how it's proceeded through the years. But men, I'm assuming men just don't want to talk about it. And it's something that we kind of need to break that barrier a little bit.
100%. Considering how far we've come, it's still such an issue that men especially won't talk about mental health at all. And it kind of leads to this bottling up and these issues. And that's why you see things like the suicide rates in men being so high. And I'd encourage anyone who's listening who feels like they have any kind of problem to talk about it with someone that you trust.
No, I agree. I mean, it's also high amongst former veterans. I mean, we will be having a major. Will he still be a former major? I can't remember. He's retiring at the moment. And Major Fox, he's quite a big advocate for this kind of sort of thing. And I'm very pro working with military veterans. So if anyone is out there and you are a military veteran and you do need help, please reach out. We also have some absolutely amazing programs out there, like Operation Florence Nightingale, my mind's going blank to the name of the organization now. Groundbreaking Heritage, that's the one I was looking for. Get in contact with those guys. They're absolutely amazing former veterans. And get some help. It's really important. Anyway, enough of me babbling, enough of Kate babbling. Let's get Joshua talking, because nobody wants to be listening to me for 45 minutes. So we're going to be talking literally about mental health, but we are going to start off with the first question, which is the word bedlam. It is used to describe a disorder and confusion, but tell us, Joshua, where does that word originate?
So bedlam was the colloquial name for the first psychiatric asylum that was set up in England, which was Bethlehem Royal Hospital, which was founded about the 13th century in the Priory of St. Mary of Bethlehem, which as the time, I think there's quite a nice quote that says that spelling's generally optional in this period of time. So you had variant spellings of it being Bethlehem and Bedlam. And that's kind of where that phrase came from, as people would use that to refer to the hospital. And then over time that melded to refer to more psychological issues as well. And you can see this quite a lot with language when it comes to asylums, of the language of the asylums being used in general conversation just to refer to mental health in general. And I think it's quite a nice point to say that when talking about these areas and these times, there's quite a lot of language that I'll use as we go through, as it was the language that was used then that we wouldn't necessarily use now. So it's not that I'm using that in the depreciating way or anything. It's just that's what at the time it would have been referred to. So if that comes out during...
Don't worry about it. We've had podcasts where we've done that, and we do highlight and say, look, however much we're going to be using words that today we don't deem appropriate, they were used at the time. So ladies and gentlemen, please don't be offended by what we're going to be doing. So go for it, Joshua.
Excellent. Yeah. So you definitely have that setup where, because it's Bethlehem Royal Hospital, the word becomes this general colloquialism for insane and for mad. And this isn't something that is isolated to history either. I've worked looking at some sites that were set up as late as 1930, where the name of those asylums is still used in the same way in that community. So where it's not as widely spread, it's more like the local version. So you have, for example, in Swansea, it's Kevin Coyd Hospital now. And there are instances that I've seen when speaking to people around the area who said that it is quite common to use phrases such as, oh, they'll be going to the Coyd, etc., in a similar way that you use the Bedlam is now used in that colloquial manner.
So there's a lot of kind of the history of asylums that's really survived then.
Yeah, definitely. There are still some that are actually open and in use. And it's just quite difficult to keep track of them because there's no kind of central way. But there's probably around seven or eight left, which are still used for mental health care purposes, be that in the old original buildings or in new facilities on the same sites.
That's incredible. I mean, I know there's a couple in Hackney. I think one of the hospitals was still, if I'm not mistaken, still open, and they revamped it, and then they revamped it, then they closed it, then they opened it. It's you are right. It's really difficult to know, is this place open? Is it not? Are they building a new one? What is happening?
Yeah, you end up having to look for things like planning records and even going back through historical maps and things to see where things were built up and where they were taken away and how those spaces developed over the time. Because it can be quite difficult, especially with a lot of records not surviving to the modern times as well.
So they did change during the course then of their lifetime. They changed even while they were in operation.
Yes, definitely. Yeah, definitely. What basically would happen was when the asylums were first set up, there was this misunderstanding of how mental health worked. So the idea was that they would build these hospitals in these areas. They would have, for example, 400 beds in this hospital. And the idea was that they would get the 400 patients in, they would come in, they'd be cured, and then they'd move on ready for the next set of patients, etc. But what they found very, very fast is that they'd set up with 400 beds, they'd get 400 patients, and there was a significant number who wouldn't leave, basically. You get like long-term patients. And that was not what they expected to happen, but it's what was always going to happen. And what they ended up doing is having to add like extensions and extra buildings. And then when it got to the point where they couldn't kind of cope much longer, I think you've got an example of the West Riding Asylum set up and had these issues. And one of their solutions was to basically open a new asylum in South Riding. So that's where you got the, you went from the Wakefield Asylum basically to the Sheffield Asylum open.
So was that set up in addition then, or was it set up instead of?
In addition, so we could provide more beds so that the patients from the South Yorkshire area, for example, could then be treated in the local area, which took pressure off the West Yorkshire Asylum.
Okay.
Right, so let's start talking a little bit about the early understanding of mental illness and the conditions that were diagnosed and how people in the first asylums were treated. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, so at the very, very early days, like when you've got Bethlehem, when it starts becoming more of a mental hospital in the 14th century, the records of patients being admitted are just as mente capti, which is just literally just means insane. So there's no kind of specific categorization in there. It's just this person is insane. They're coming into Bethlehem. and treatment early on, if it's the right word, was kind of things like manacles and solitary confinement, very much like you'd see in prisons and jails. But realistically, at this time, we don't know like a lot about the treatment that was going on. But when you get towards like the 17th century, maybe early 18th, that's when you start to get the records of things like hydrotherapy, which were just cold, at the time, were just cold baths, like ice cold baths. And there were, you had records showing people being basically strapped down and then placed into the bath so they couldn't move and couldn't get out. And then you also get references to patients being bled, patients for procedures such as like scarification, and then later on leeches, the whole four humours thing of like bloodletting and enforced vomiting and defecation and things like that, just to kind of get the balance of the body right, etc. And when you get towards like the late 18th century, you start getting those accusations that these treatments were unnecessarily violent. So I think, but then that was kind of like a very public argument between the family running Bethlehem at the time and then the people running, I think it was St. Luke's, which is another asylum kind of just across London. And they had this like really public feud about the treatment in Bethlehem and how it was kind of entrenched in its archaic systems and therefore continuing with things that were felt to be outdated still, even at that time.
So what were they trying to achieve with some of these treatments? I mean, what was the idea? What did they think was causing this insanity that they just lumped into one diagnosis? And, you know, what were they hoping to achieve by nearly drowning people or bleeding people and this sort of thing?
There was this misunderstanding of knowing what mental health was. So there's a long history of these mental health conditions being diagnosed as being like physical problems. So like the idea of four humours, going back to like Hippocrates and Galen and this kind of thing of having like black bile, yellow bile, blood, and what was the fourth one?
Phlegm.
Thank you very much. I've never been so excited by phlegm. And so you've got these four, like basically humours or whatever you want to call them, that they felt got out of balance within the body. And therefore they were trying to kind of put them into balance. And they thought that this would therefore solve the problems that the patients were having. And things like the cold baths and things, it's a similar kind of logic to things like ECT and things, just like that sharp reset kind of idea.
Yeah, like a shock almost. That, I mean, the poor person nearly being drowned, you'd be absolutely exhausted, or having however many pints of blood drained, you'd be exhausted. I mean, so you would, I guess, naturally be quieter after a treatment like that.
Yeah, definitely. And then things like restraints and things, if you manacle or tie someone up for long enough, they're just going to give up. So I guess there's kind of a perverse illusion of success in there, in a way. Yeah.
Kat, I just want to jump down in. They're literally mentally breaking these people down, is the bottom line.
Yeah. And that's what I was going to ask. Yeah, is there like a moral kind of religious thing, because they are breaking their spirit, aren't they?
That is an excellent point that I'd not thought about before. Yeah, but yes, potentially, yeah.
So initially, the purpose of the asylums was kind of more to segregate sufferers from society, if I'm correct, right? But around the turn of the 19th century, there was a move to reform mental health care, wasn't there? So who were the main people involved, and what did they do? What actions did they take to try and instigate this change?
Yeah, so when you get to the like beginning of the 19th century, you've got like the Asylum Acts starting to be brought in. So you've got new county asylums, which are being set up by asylum boards. And these are kind of more of a structured institution for people to go into. And when, as we spoke about right at the start, these got built, but because of the planning and because of the misunderstanding, they were very quickly overcrowded and stuff. So what you got was a almost like a counter movement, which was in Europe it had been Pinel, but in the UK it had been like William Tuke, who were kind of pioneers of treatment in this time. So what happened with William Tuke is he went into the York Asylum and saw the overcrowding and the treatment that was happening in there, and then he saw the death of a young Quaker girl called Hannah Mills in about 1790 that he witnessed. And what happened from there is, he was a Quaker himself, and what happened there is basically he decided this isn't right, this isn't good, this can be done in a much better way. So 2 years later, like after consultation and after gathering funds through the Quaker community and things like that, he sets up the York Retreat. And what the York Retreat does is it looks to kind of incorporate all of the kind of Quaker ideology around equality and patients being treated like human beings, to be given equal respect to everyone else. And what must be said is that Tuke he wasn't a doctor. He didn't know much about like healthcare in general. But what he did implement was this kind of practice of like a social treatment for mental health rather than physical. So it was kind of like one of those big steps in like mental health history. So he starts looking at things like just simple things like negative behavior would be punished, but the idea was that there wasn't they weren't manacling like patients as a standard practice, only in extreme cases. So you've got restraint being used much less. But then also, if there was positive behavior, patients would also be rewarded. So it's kind of like that kind of moral balance of guiding people towards the right decision, almost, that you see in teaching. Like, and then what was also set out was things like routines. So patients would have chores, they'd have leisure time, they'd have a routine to get themselves into so they weren't just kind of languishing, bored, stuck in their own head. They'd have a routine to follow, which are a lot of the things that we still use now when we start thinking about these kind of things. And what was also I wouldn't say it was invented for this, but it was because of their position and because they weren't in this overcrowded state, they could diligently classify and separate patients both by sex and by the severity of illness, which is something that the county asylums were struggling to do considering how many patients they had. And it was more of a get them in where they can go kind of situation. And I think quite a nice quote to round off is from William Tuke's grandson Samuel, because he said the lines of, "There is, however, one remedy which is frequently employed at the retreat and which appears to have been attended with the happiest effects, and that is the warm bath." So you're moving away from that cold submersion and forced to a nice warm bath to be calming and therapeutic. And it's
everyone
so
loves a warm bath.
Yeah, it's so much nicer as a kind of an outlook.
I'm really curious at this point. We're talking about state-funded asylums. Were there any private ones that had overall better conditions where, I don't know, you could pay a lot of money for the rich people and you would have a much better quality of care?
Yes, there were. The retreat was a private asylum when it was set up. And that's one of the reasons why it was much easier. And the difference between the public and the private was so distinct because, like you said, in the same way that now you've almost got like the NHS is understaffed, underfunded, et cetera, et cetera. It was kind of the same at the time in that there were so many patients that were struggling to cope. A private asylum could set up with their own money and admit as fewer as many patients as they wanted that they had in the space and had a lot more control because they didn't have a responsibility in a way. They had a more of a free rein to do what they wished. So yeah, there was definitely a distinction in the care that was provided between the both. So there would have been a distinction between what were known as pauper patients and then private ones. And
in a sudden flash, it all comes clear. It's a eureka moment, an epiphany. Hi, I'm Marcus Smith, host of the Constant Wonder podcast. The world offers marvel, meaning, and mystery around every single corner. In nature, art, science, culture, history, we talk everything from bees and beetles to obelisks and asteroids. Experience the thrill of transformative encounter. We'll bring more wonder to your day.
Listen to Constant Wonder wherever you get your podcasts.
One thing that you do see, though, is that the private asylums were more prone to manipulation of patients being admitted. So you do see examples of allusions to patients being admitted to basically because they're maybe because they're in a line of succession and they want them out of the way, or they're being mouthy, or they're being difficult and families just want them out of the way because you could just pay, put them in, gone, problem solved.
Speaking of that, then that kind of leads quite nicely onto our next point, doesn't it? Insofar as with the in terms of discrimination, I mean, records show that there were a lot more women than men in asylums, don't they? Why was this, and were they treated differently? In what ways? Because I'm sure they were treated differently. In what ways were they treated differently from the men? How was that? How did you see that discrimination?
Yeah. So there's a lot. There's a few factors that this could come down to. So one is, like we said before, the general misunderstanding of mental health, but also a general misunderstanding of women's health as well. And this can be demonstrated by looking at some of the official reasons for admittance on the records. And there's one in particular popular image that's gone around the internet that is quite fascinating.
I've seen that image.
Yeah. And I'm just going to read out a couple that are from there and a couple of other places just to show how ridiculous some of them were as they went down. So we have things like imaginary female trouble, fits and desertion of husband, suppression of menses, women trouble, female disease.
I'm really curious about the
records as they were written. They weren't always very kind of, I'd say, medical or very professional. You do see cases where it just says something along the lines of horse, and the assumption would be that someone got kicked in the head by a horse or something, or someone being kicked by a horse, but the form would just say horse. And so what we'll say is that this is just like things that doctors have written in. So you get, I think the other couple that I've got on there are gynecological disorder, hysteria, which is quite a common one, and menstrual deranged, which is probably the weirdest phrase I've seen written on a medical form. Something else that comes out of this, and you can kind of see, it's kind of alluded to in the list that's there, is that women are kind of were seen as the fairer sex and described as being weak and unable to cope and all that kind of rubbish. So, yeah, everyday kind of 19th, 20th century sexism comes into that as well. And when looking through archives, the other big one that's I found quite shocking when I first like started reading about it was that you can get women who are committed for the asylums for the grievous crime of having a child out of wedlock. And so they would basically, the baby would be taken away, they'd be put in. And I remember distinctly, I really wish I could remember her name, but I remember distinctly finding the records of this 19, 20 year old woman. I think she might have been called Alice, when kind of she was admitted to the asylum for having a child out of wedlock, but was still there like 50 years later.
So I was talking to a nurse, because I actually work at a health clinic, and I was talking to a nurse only yesterday, and she mentioned that when she was doing her training, she'd done a short period on a psychiatric ward, and there was a lady, a very elderly lady who lived there, who'd been born in the very late 1800s, who'd been born out of wedlock and had been in this mental hospital since she was born.
Yeah, exactly.
Was that common then?
I wouldn't say it was common. It was not uncommon for it to happen. Okay. I found records of women who have spent almost their entire lives in these asylums, and it's the fact that when it came to it, and I'm sure when your friend was there as well, when these people have been there for 50, 60 years, you kind of have this thing where they're in there for something which is now not frowned upon at all, but they're still there. And part of this is kind of people being institutionalized and not really knowing how to be out, not they've always been there, so they've kind of this problem when they come out and things. Treatment, when it comes down to things like treatment, the biggest example that I can find is things like ECT, like electroconvulsive therapy, because women were like two to three times more likely to be treated with ECT than men. So approximately about 70-ish% of all ECT patients are women. And this could be linked to the fact that women are more likely to be diagnosed with depression. But then again, that diagnosis itself is probably gendered as well. So it's kind of this kind of vicious circle almost of a misunderstanding that we still have.
So basically diagnosed by
men? Yes, basically. Can you imagine if there was a female doctor at the time writing things like menstrual deranged?
She just wouldn't, would she?
I can't imagine it.
I looked at that list and I'm sitting there thinking, what are some of this stuff really just doesn't make sense. Like, why would you go in there for, I don't know, for example, you're annoyed with your husband, he's been cheating, you slap him in the face. Oh, well, she's having a deranged menstrual, whatever it is. And I'm like, you could go into an asylum for the stupidest things just because your husband would say, oh, well, she's crazy, let's lock her up.
They didn't question it, did they? They just took him at his word.
Well, they didn't.
No,
exactly.
There's a historian called Nancy Tomes who suggests that around that time, doctors would lean towards confirming diagnoses made by family members rather than diagnosing themselves. Yeah. It seems to ring true in some of these, because like you said, they definitely sound like things that someone's just gone, oh, she hit me. She's menstrual deranged, lock her up kind of thing, rather than a doctor actually, you know, diagnosing and having it from like a medical standpoint.
So women, again, women, yep. Underline this, women are often wrongly committed. Was Alice Christina Abbott one example of this?
Yes, she was. So there were both known and suspected cases of women being wrongly committed to asylums for a number of reasons, but they come down to a couple of overarching themes: the misunderstanding of health that we've talked about before, a level of mismanagement, which you can see in, like, I don't know if you know about Nellie Bly, who was the American investigative reporter, went into an asylum kind of undercover to report on the conditions. And one of the things that she found was that there were actually kind of a number of female immigrants in those asylums who had just been put there for poor spoken English, were probably supposed to have gone to a workhouse, but obviously the language barrier meant they were there. And then most interestingly, as we're kind of going to be talking about now, there's kind of that idea of control and of reputational control, especially. So women placed in asylums for the heinous crimes of things like arguing with their husbands or a lack of modesty or a difference of religious belief. And also some evidence, like I mentioned before, of social and economic benefits to family members of people being admitted. Alice Christina Abbott is one of the admissions. She was an American girl in about 1867, and she killed her stepfather, right? And allegedly by poisoning his tea. And she claimed that to have done so because he had been having an improper connection with her since she was 13, right? And when
so she, just to clarify, improper connection, basically he was sexually abusing her.
Yes.
I mean, not beating about the bush, he was...
Yeah, but yeah, yeah, basically, yes. From when she was 13 years old through to 17. And unsurprisingly, she showed no remorse for his death when they were in the trial, as I don't think many people would.
I'm not surprised.
The fact that she was the one on trial is annoying in the first place, but then the accusations that she was making and like the idea, like the defense that she was putting forward, she got completely dismissed, right? And just sent into an asylum as being mad. And that's the last record that we have of her life, of her being sent. We don't even know, as far as I'm aware, of records of her being there. But this kind of, I fully believe that this is one example of kind of reputational control and trying to mitigate scandal in what could be a small community, in what could be a large family in a small community, etc. And it's just one of those cases which is just infuriating, in that you can kind of see how just dismissive people were and how asylums were kind of like the almost like a catch-all, but we don't want to deal with this, you can go over there kind of thing.
Almost like a dumping ground or
yeah, exactly. You're not a problem anymore. You're now away. Yeah. You're now.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, "What the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?" So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
So asylums and kind of the study of mental health then were used as a means really of controlling women and oppressing them, weren't they? Is that what happened to Elizabeth Packard?
It's kind of like almost a fantastic story whilst also being absolutely horrific. So Elizabeth Ware Packard, an American teacher in America, married to a Calvinist minister who, by the name of Theophilus Packard, which is a villain's name if you ever heard one. And the couple have 6 children, and she's a school teacher, and she starts to express religious differences with her husband. And I believe he was quite much older than she was, so I don't know whether there was some kind of, almost like arranged marriage situation there. But she starts to express her own opinions, which is obviously at the time a massive problem. And they disagreed and they argued on things such as religion and slavery at the time. And what could happen was basically at the time, a husband could have his wife committed to his asylum, just on their own choice, so without a hearing, without her consent. And therefore she was like sent to the Jacksonville Insane Asylum in 1860. She stayed there for about 3 years before her children basically made a fuss. And she was discharged discharged as incurable and back into the care of her husband. And what he did was basically he nailed shut the windows on the nursery, and he just locked her in the nursery of their home, and she wasn't allowed to leave because it would have been embarrassing and he didn't want to deal with it. Things, all those horrible things. What she managed to do from her nursery is pass a note out the window to a friend, and her friend took this note to like kind of local judiciary law enforcement, and she managed to secure a trial. And at this trial, basically what happened is Theophilus, being like the Calvinist minister and being this big person in the community, got his family and his congregation to all trot up and basically say, oh yeah, she's insane. Yep, she's definitely insane. And then you got the cases of the people who weren't in his, for want of a better word, flock, who were saying, no, we've never seen anything issue, there's no problem. And what it kind of came down to was there was a final testament given by a doctor called Dr. Duncanson, who basically, a quote from him was basically, I did not agree with her on many things, but I do not call people insane because they differ with me. You might as much propriety call Christ insane or Luther or Robert Fuller. I pronounce her a sane woman and wish we had a nation of such women. And she was, as a result, she was cleared of insanity and allowed to leave. Now, on her return to her home, which was the home that she was a prisoner in, the home that she shared with her husband, she found out it had been rented to another family the day before she was released. And all her belongings had been sold, and her husband had left the state with the children. And she went to the courts, she appealed to the courts, but at the time, married women in America had no claim to either their belongings or their children or anything along those lines. So she didn't really have an official recourse to go down. And at this point is where she then kind of builds herself up. She sets up the Anti-Insane Asylum Society in America and commits herself to campaigning for kind of women's rights. And in her campaigning, she managed to get multiple states to pass laws and change the law to make sure that people being admitted, including married women, have a right to a trial before they go and have a right to be defend themselves before they're just admitted. So it's one of those stories that she makes such a difference when it comes to the end, but the fact that she had to go through what she did to get there is incredible in a, not in the good sense, but in the, it's almost not credible sense.
It is incredible, absolutely. And we know about her, but I'm sure there must be loads of other similar.
Yeah, because you think that you see cases like Alice Abbott, and you see cases like Elizabeth Ware Packard, and then you think, how many people didn't we see? How many people didn't receive a trial, yeah, didn't get the chance?
Just got stuffed in there and forgotten about.
Yeah, exactly.
So by the Victorian era, asylums had sort of to some extent fallen sort of foul of their own success, no? And were operating more sort of as correctional institutions on a lot of occasions, sort of incarcerating inmates rather than sort of treating sufferers. So what effect did this success have on the institutions and those living and working in them?
I'm not certain about the falling foul of their own success, but like we said before, the fundamental flaw in the asylums was this idea that of a certain amount of curing and people being dismissed and stuff. So the problem they had is that they weren't prepared for those long-term patients, which led to a steady rise in patient numbers, which then meant that there was insufficient space, insufficient staff, and they were struggling to basically successfully manage the growing patient population. And what happened was that wards kind of became these repositories of beds where the beds would be like an inch apart on each side. And you'd end up with like so many patients in a single room that they'd have to kind of like crawl around and to get to their beds and things. And conditions were frankly horrific. And you kind of got this massive pressure that comes on the staff because there's not very many of them. There's a lot of patients. And then things like the manacles, well, not manacles, but things like the physical restraints and things start to become much more widely used again and used much more often, just as a way of managing with that pressure and that overwhelming number of patients in the asylum, which is where things start to go backwards. And that's where this kind of carceral environment comes from. Because there's just nothing, there's nowhere to put the patients. There's no, in the space that they've got, they can't really, they've kind of, this whole idea of the asylum being, well, what it was intended to be, where the word asylum comes from, this like retreat, the separation, the calm, the almost like the oasis is destroyed in a way because there's too many, they don't have this quiet, spacious grounds and airiness that they were supposed to be treated with and being relaxed. It goes right back to Tuke, that idea. And instead, they've just got probably what's more chaotic than the life they came from. And they've got so many people there and so many people in such a small space that it becomes almost animalistic. And this kind of, the institutions as a whole, therefore, kind of just ended up being an alternative prison almost. And just
if you hadn't got mental health problems, you know, and you were put in, as we've discussed, some people were, you'd certainly have mental health problems after you'd been in there, wouldn't you?
Quite possibly, yeah. And the other thing, though, is if there's so many patients, then the time that anyone gets with each individual patient goes down. And like, so there's much less of an overview of each individual patient. So even if a patient shouldn't be there, the likelihood of it being noticed is very low.
They were basically forgotten. People forgot that they were there. They didn't receive the treatment that they were supposed to and just kind of left to their own devices at the end of the day, I suppose.
Yeah. Definitely, yeah.
Okay, so let's move forward a little bit to the second half of the 20th century, because that move sees the total closure of some psychiatric facilities. Yeah. But closing asylum doesn't stop people having mental illnesses. Obviously, they're still ongoing. What did the closures mean for these patients?
Well, I think the issue with the closure was that it was around, it was 1961, Enoch Powell did his big speech, which is known as the Water Tower speech, where he basically says, psychiatric asylums are a relic of an old system. They're not fit for purpose. We shouldn't be using them. We should close them all right now. And have done with it. And basically, he basically then went on to announce that he was going to cut like 50% of all inpatient asylum beds in asylums. And there was no more money available for any maintenance or refurbishment of the old asylums because they didn't want to waste any money on them. And what basically happened there is, in this kind of ideological haste to close those asylums, it was often kind of done before they had a comprehensive plan and system worked out for when they had closed. So the patients that had been residing in the asylum, some of which had been there for decades and some of which were very much institutionalized, were then discharged into community care. And this, in some instances, has been described as, I think it's Walsh and Deer, Landscapes of Despair, which is like a misassignment or transinstitutionalization into inappropriate institutions. So where these patients are then discharged from the mental hospitals, they either end up in like prisons, jails, general hospital wards, other institutional settings that are less specialized and less appropriate for them. And there's a full acknowledgement that the asylums weren't perfect and in some cases weren't working. But this wasn't an improvement for those patients. Like, those patients that were kind of long-term patients needed that care, didn't have that option anymore. So whereas for patients with less severe problems, this may have been a positive, because then instead of being, they could be like live their normal lives, but just have contact. Those who needed that care and who were discharged had a much worse time of it.
I guess it would have had a really, really big effect on the people who we spoke about earlier. We said the people who were institutionalized, people who've been in a psychiatric hospital for 30, 40 years.
Yeah, definitely. And the other issue that you start to see is in these, like, obviously, these were set up when they're kind of separated from communities, or from like people and things. As time goes on, urban sprawl and all that, all these asylums start to be like in the middle of communities. But they would always been there, so people weren't like, people would use these language like we talked about in the beginning about them, but they wouldn't be like campaigning for them to not be there.
No.
What happens when the asylums start to close is you start to need community provision, and you start to need I can't remember the word for it now, but if you've got care in the community, you'd basically need those day houses, the day centres for those patients to go in the community. And what starts to happen is that the communities turn around and say, for want of a better phrase, not in my backyard, like the NIMBY stuff. Mm.
So like, yeah, they were really shunned, weren't they? The people were really, really shunned and outcast.
Yeah, so that it was kind of like, well, yeah, we recognise that there needs to be services, but we don't want them here. We want them somewhere else, kind of idea. And it's a big whole issue around that as well, which kind of leans into this whole stigma that was attached to the patients and things like that as well.
Yeah, they changed the names, didn't they, during the 20th century, rephrased everything.
Yeah, some asylums had their names changed on multiple occasions. So if you looking for records of asylums, sometimes it can be quite difficult to follow the track, because they could have like 10 names over their lifetime, just as this gradually changed. In the when the NHS took control in the 1948, all these asylums kind of come under their umbrella. So then you see a gradual change where psychiatric asylums become hospitals and inmates become patients, and along those lines. So you see the wording change. But the problem, and you kind of get they're all under the same umbrella, you see kind of almost like the possibility of a national strategy and kind of this national approach. But they have exactly the same issues as they had before.
So yeah.
They're still understaffed, they're still underfunded, they're still oversubscribed, and therefore the same issues are still there that there were before. So although there was some change and there would have been some benefits to that change, a lot of the core issues aren't resolved by that process, by that move.
changing the name of a place or changing the terminology used to describe people in the place isn't going to massively change the treatment or the conditions, is it?
No, I think the main thing that it does, what I will say, is it almost changes the narrative in a little way. So it's
the public perception.
Yes, it's one of those steps towards more acceptance by stopping using these kind of archaic terms that we used before. Start kind of bringing it under the health banner rather than under a separate banner. Yeah. So people start to think of it as, oh, it's a health problem. To an extent, not fully, because like we've discussed at the start, we're still not there yet.
No.
Yeah.
My dad actually trained as an RMN at one of these such places that we're talking about, Burntwood Asylum. Though by the time he was there, it was known as Matthew's Hospital.
Yeah.
Typical case. And it was closed in 1995 as part of the government's Care in the Community programme. And it was redeveloped for residential use. I understand most of the buildings were demolished. Only the admin block, chapel and social club remained. Although we were looking at it on Google Maps the other day, and the building that they're calling the admin building, we weren't sure if it was all admin or if it was part ward, and they'd kind of described it, shall we say.
Yeah.
So is this sort of redevelopment for residential use common, and how does the history and the redevelopment, how do they affect each other? How does one dictate the other?
Yeah, there are quite a number of ways in which asylums are redeveloped, the most common of which is for housing and residential purposes. And the biggest challenge that they face when they're redeveloping these sites is kind of how to manage the history associated with the sites. And when that use is commercial, or when it's like going to be a commercial issue, so like if they're going to build houses that they then need to sell and things along those lines, they need to kind of, that's when marketers come in, right? And the marketing people come in and say, well, this old psychiatric asylum is tainted, we don't really want to discuss this in this way. So then what they start to do is kind of manipulate the language that's used and kind of manipulate the history of those sites. And it's quite an interesting in the way that the language is used. There's one which is the former Free and Barnet Asylum, or the Free and Barnet Hospital, which is now known as Princess Park Manor. Right. And it's quite a luxurious development, let's say. And it's one of those it's in London. It's been home to things like Arsenal footballers, members of people like JLS and One Direction, et cetera, et cetera. And so, yeah, so you get the idea of it being quite an exclusive place. And their marketing text on their website says, Princess Park Manor is an award-winning period-listed building set in 30 acres of private parkland. The development has been sensitively and imaginatively converted to combine elegance and exquisite proportion of its heritage with the convenience and comfort expected in the modern age. Now, I use this quote a lot, right? Way too much. But it's a perfect example of how language is used to promote the modern kind of luxury housing. And it's very similar to the language that was used for the original asylum. So
I was just thinking that it's almost going back to its original like intention.
Yeah, going back to those original ideas of separation and quiet and elegance of the buildings and privateness. And it's kind of come full circle. So they're now pushing that in the narrative for these residential flats. But they completely kind of gloss over the actual use of the building. So they almost
dismiss it out, don't they?
Yeah. So it's kind of like you can almost see the gap where it should be said, but it's not there. So they kind of end up with this whole thing where they're trying to distinguish the new and the old, but they're trying to use the positive parts that they see of the old buildings, this whole grand aesthetic and this whole all that, whilst trying to ignore the actual asylums themselves. And you see this in quite a few locations. And it's almost this whole idea of selective remembrance and strategic forgetting. So this whole idea of the memory of these sites are going to be kind of detoxified and all the nasty bits are going to be taken out. and history is going to be molded into this kind of commodity that we can sell.
Yeah.
Right. And sorry, just to go on a slight tangent to that, like housing is the most common of these like fates that you get for these asylums and the most common way in which they're redone for various reasons. But you do get other like more bizarre in a way developments for them because the space is quite an easy one to use because they had like separated rooms and then large wards. They're quite easy to segment and to turn into different things. So the other ones you can get are things like student housing. So you get quite a few instances of asylums being redeveloped for university purposes, either for offices or for accommodation, which to be honest explains a lot. And you get one or two which could be prisons, which again makes sense with the layout. But I believe there was one in Surrey, which the old chapel and a couple of buildings are being used as a Buddhist monastery, for example. So there's a very wow. wide variety of all these different uses that some of them are still used for. Whereas then you get a significant amount then that were also demolished. So you kind of have this half and half situation. But even where they're demolished, there are sometimes like indicators that the asylum was there. So they'll like the roads in the new housing estates and stuff will be named after what the old wards were named and things. But like those kind of things where if you didn't know, you wouldn't notice it.
But yeah, if you weren't looking for it, you wouldn't see it. Like,
yeah,
I mean, it's great that some are redeveloped, so we do save the architecture, but yeah. there's so much more that is so much more important that we are losing, that we are forgetting.
Yeah, what's the? I think the issue that you find is that there's very little in the way of like sites of remembrance. So although the buildings remain, the sites don't tend to have any kind of indication of the previous use. So there's no like memorial, there's no plaque, there's no like anything to do with what the history was. So I think the limit, there's a very limited amount. There was a study done of the redevelopment in the early 2000s. I think it was Chaplin and Peters. They looked at 34 of these sites. And what they found is there was like one plaque, one memorial garden, and then a display of photos in the Imperial War Museum, and that was like it.
Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, we've heard asylums, with rare exception, were pretty horrific places, and it's common for Victorians to visit them, like they were sort of a sideshow, a sort of macabre zoo, right? Can this be likened in any way to the popularity of shows like American Horror Story or films like Shutter Island? And why do we continue? Because as we've said, often it's glossed over, but often it's also kind of distorted into like a grotesque sort of caricature of reality that's used for entertainment.
Yeah, definitely. I love this question, by the way. Yeah, there's almost an obsession with asylums being like these dark, horrifying spaces, almost glorified in the stigma that they've had attached to them. And I think that kind of in part comes down to almost an interest and intrigue in the unknown. And with the other being either something to fear or idolise, or in the case of the asylum, occasionally both. And there's a case to be had for the argument that as humans, we're obsessed with things like the murder documentaries and horror films because we have the desire to kind of understand what's going on in people's heads. So we watch things like serial killers on crime documentaries, and we just want to know why, what's the motivation, what's the thought in the head, and we become kind of obsessed with that idea. And I think also the reputation these sites had and the stories that came out of them catches our imaginations, but not necessarily in a good way. And we see these asylums vilified a lot in media. You mentioned things like Shutter Island, which is a horrific watch when you watching it with a historical thing in mind. And you've got things like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and even things like Supernatural. Well, like those kind of Supernatural, like mild horror programs, where they kind of bring it in as like a almost like a cheap trope in a way. And what they all have in common is kind of this depiction of awful conditions, maltreatment and medical experimentation as well. And in this, there's kind of another argument that as humans, we kind of like to oversimplify. So we like to see things in a very kind of binary way. So we're very much if there's things that we don't have a lot of knowledge on, and well, it's not just, I'm not just saying like, oh, public stuff, it's me as well. Everyone does it. If you don't know much about something, you're quite likely to fall back into a kind of binary perspective on it. And in that way, kind of asylums were bad. Like, asylum bad, full stop. And this is much more pronounced then when you come to the fiction and this kind of obsession with the other and the unreal and the different, because we kind of like fantasize almost about it in that way and use it for like things like Halloween and how we like, we watch horror films to be scared. We kind of, the idea of the asylum is in that kind of the same way. We like the way in which we think about it, if you know what I mean.
Joshua, that was so enlightening. Thank you so much for joining us. And we should get you back on again to do a bit more asylum work. So thank you so much.
Definitely. Thank you for having me. I had a really good time.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me as well, Alina, and letting me take over. Perhaps a little too enthusiastic.
It's all right. Don't worry about it. It's all good.
Never apologize for enthusiasm.
You can help us at History Hack by joining us via Patreon. It takes quite a lot of effort and a lot of work of quite a big team now to keep us going. And so if you could donate as little as £3 a month, it would be massively appreciated by all of us. There's different levels because Princess Marcus has set it all up with varying rewards and things. So do have a look. Do join us. There's an exclusive Facebook group as well, and you could be part of all of it.
When our guests join us to talk about their work and their new book, the 45 minutes or so they spend with us is just a taster of all their efforts. So to this end, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest and greatest books. You can support them and you can support History Hack too. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep at it and bring you more amazing guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/hackhistory, or just search on bookshop.org for us under the shops bit. Thank you for your continued support, and here's to your next great book.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers, with rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.